Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport, the home of cycling in association with Zwift, where fun is fast. I'm Graham Wilgos. Brad, it's good to see you.
Yeah, we're back.
We're back socially distanced.
We are.
There's a screen in between us.
I can't see you.
And we barely see each other, but we can hear each other, and that's the most important thing.
Yeah.
And we'll also be able to hear our guest this week.
It is Laura Winter. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you very much for having me. Very happy to be here.
Presenter, broadcaster and podcaster, to give you a title of sorts. Is that fair enough, Laura?
I think that's fair. I think that says it all.
Brad, what's been going on then? How have you kept yourself busy over the winter?
Not much. I mean,
in lockdown.
Yeah. Since Christmas, I just tried to do a bit more training and stuff, really get a bit fitter, try not to drink as much. I was getting into a bit of a rut last year working with you.
You know, people say that, yeah. It's what they turn to.
We did. We spent a lot of time in Bath, didn't we? Not in the bath, but in Bath. And
important distinction.
You know, it's just easy to sort of have a drink after work and stuff, isn't it? So just my goal this year is to get a bit fitter and kind of, maybe even start riding the bike. Who knows?
Admirable. Laura, what about you? You like a bit of Zwift, actually, don't you?
I do, yeah. I've spent a lot of time on Zwift over the last 2 months. Probably more time than I'd have liked, but we're in lockdown and it was a grim winter. So yeah, a lot of time on the bike. But it's been good. It's been all right. As lockdowns go, it's not been too bad.
New season ahead then, or new season that's already off and running, fully off and running, with Strada Bianchi today. So I should say we're recording on Saturday. We'll come to the races. First, I just want to cover a few bits and pieces that have happened, Brad, while we've been away, starting with someone who won't, we think, play a part in any of this season, Tom Dumoulin.
Yeah.
Jumbo-Visma. So he said, seemingly very suddenly, having played his part in pre-season training camp, he came out and said, look, I need some time off the bike. I need some time away to sort of figure out what I'm doing with my life. He got quite deep. And just to quote one of the many things he said about it, he said, I'm going to look for what I want with the bike. What do I want as a human being with my life? Mm. And that sort of made me think of you, and looking back on your career, and whether there was a point where if you could have done, you would have taken a break.
Mm. Well, it's probably many times, but the easiest one for me to say would be 2013. But post-tour, post, being the poster boy in the era when Lance Armstrong came clean, in the whole Oprah thing, being the tour champion. But then that's kind of a little bit, there's a lot of context to it because of obviously the fame side of things in this country, and I didn't necessarily handle it the right way either. So it could be a bit of a cop-out in some ways, but at the end of the day, you end up where you end up mentally, and I definitely needed some sort of a break from life at that point. And I think, it seems a lot easier now for riders to be able to do that. The danger is people just jump on the bandwagon of saying, well, I want a bit of time out and that. And it is a very fine line between, kind of, I'd say the serious ones and the ones who are really bad, because, how bad can it get? But it's not a competition with mental health, and it's definitely something that needs, always sort of needs some sort of intervention from a third party, sort of that has the interests of the health of the riders and the well-being of the riders first and foremost. Aside from the team, we always had Steve Peters at Team Sky, who I always thought was probably supposed to have your back. But I mean, I think, him being on senior management, head of the medical team there, his interests were to Team Sky at that time, really. And it was about getting the assets back riding and strong enough to perform. And when I look back now, I don't think he was there for the health and well-being of the riders as an individual, where he could stand up to Team Sky and say, look, this guy needs 6 weeks away. But the team seem a lot more agreeable now, really. We've saw it with Pete Kenner a couple of years ago, didn't we?
And Marcel Kittel. Well.
But yeah, there's definitely a lot more acceptable now that it's taken a lot more seriously when someone puts their hands up. And it doesn't happen that often. And I suppose it's still at the risk of the rider themselves, because they have to think, well, is my place going to be at stake? Am I going to be able to come into the sport? But I think it's a very good thing.
Laura, were you surprised at just how willingly Jumbo-Visma seemed to accept Tom Dumoulin's need to step away?
No, I think society has become a lot more sensitive to mental health, hasn't it, in kind of recent years, certainly more so than you were saying, Brad, in 2013. And sport is a microcosm of society, and therefore sport has to react as well. And you'd argue that actually mental health within sport is kind of that top 1% of elite. So it's going to be those tiny, fine margins between winning and losing, and you're kind of teetering on the edge of mental health in that sense anyway. So I wasn't too surprised. I think it was brilliant to see, actually. It's refreshing to see as well that a sports team said, you're one of our strongest riders and we've signed you for this season. And, you know, all he did in 2020 as well with the success of Jumbo-Visma, for them to say he needs time out, give it to him, I think it was great to see.
Mm. From one man who won't play his part this season to two men who hopefully will, Fabio Jakobsen and Remco Evenepoel. To Koenig Quickstep, both of them have said on social media in the past week that they're making their way back. So Remco says, nothing is holding me back anymore to start the preparation for my season. Whereas Jakobsen, who as we all remember all too well, had that horror crash at the Tour of Poland, has said almost time to restart again. Healing process seems to be going well. The last 3 weeks have been painful and I struggled with eating and drinking. But implants / screws are in and scar tissue removal reconstruction is completed. So he says another 4 or 5 months to let everything heal. Hopefully, Brad, we'll see him come the end of this season.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's looking positive, isn't it? I mean, I've been following Remco's progress actually through the winter, and he looks a better version of himself than he did pre-crash. He's been so motivated and on the ball, and I think we're going to see big things from him this season. It seems, again, that's another thing. These riders, you know, Chris Froome, you know, he's come back as well, isn't he, obviously, from his crash 2 years ago, but... Yeah, Jakobsen, I mean, it'll be a great day when we see him back in the peloton.
Yeah, one to celebrate.
Yeah.
For sure. And Laura, the Tour of Poland downhill finish where Jakobsen crashed won't be used again.
That's very welcome news, isn't it? But I did see at the sort of Polish Sports Award that won sports event of the year. And I just find that extraordinary that they can say where a rider almost lost their life. Well done. What a great event that was. We did that really well. It's just... mind-blowing to me, yeah.
A crazy thing to gloss over.
Yes.
On other things that the UCI have not got right, arguably, well, for this occasion, they've banned hugging in order to send, they say, the right coronavirus message to fans, which in the grand context of things and with teams being in race bubbles where risks are so very low, that seems an odd place to focus your attention.
Yeah. So what are you going to do if you hug someone?
Well, I mean, it's already, we'll find out because it's already out the window after the finish for the women's race at Strada Bianchi today.
Right. That's another.
It's all rightly treated with contempt. We saw at the finish there, Anna van der Breggen embracing her teammate.
Yeah, straight in to give Chantal van der Broek-Black a hug, as you rightly would. And I think it's very difficult to deny that sort of very human reaction to a win and to happiness and to joy. It does remind me of rugby, where they have said they can't high five or hug when they score tries, but you can pack down in a scrum.
Yes.
Go ahead, boys, but don't high five in a celebration. It just sort of very much defeats the object. But I do understand the optics argument. But it's a difficult one, isn't it, for fans to sort of think, oh, that won't really wash.
Another curiosity we saw in both the men's and the women's race was the hazmat-suited bounce. Well, I'm going to call them bouncers because that's effectively what they were. But again, a very odd thing to see.
I know.
And not necessarily an effective one.
I'm not sure they were hazmat. They were sort of white, horrible white tracksuits. I'm not really sure what they were or what sort of purpose they were serving. But yeah, it was an interesting finish, wasn't it? There was just a lot of joy from the SD Works women, which you can expect. And I think it was lovely to see. I didn't once think while I was watching it, God, they shouldn't be hugging. I thought they've been tested and tested and tested and they're in the race. And they've just won the race with superb, stunning teamwork. So crack on.
Yeah, I mean, it came down to a shootout between Chantal van den Broek-Black and Elisa Longo-Borghini at Trek Segafredo in their two-up breakaway in the closing kilometres. I think after Longo-Borghini did all the work, it was always going to be an open door for van den Broek-Black to sort of push on in the end. So she came in 7 seconds ahead with van der Breggen. Her SD Works teammate coming in 9 seconds behind the winner. Annemiek van Vleuten in fourth, which was possibly the biggest surprise today that she didn't podium, knowing how strong she is, particularly in a race like this, and sort of memories of the same race last year and how strong she was.
Yeah, absolutely. She beat Mavi Garcia last year to the line. And I think she's had a much quieter start to the season than we certainly saw last year. She said she was out of position at Omloop, had Noiseblood last weekend, and then didn't feature in that final either. So there's kind of unknowns there regarding her form. But I mean, hats off to SD Works. It takes nothing away from the fact that they were the best riders on the day, best teamwork on the day. And it was somewhat of a surprise to see Vanderbroek Black as the winner today. I think she went up the road as a sort of foil for Vanderbreggen.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then they just never caught her. And she had Elisa Longo-Borghini with her as well. And she obviously, with Vanderbreggen behind, wasn't going to get on the front and do any of the work. Sat on Longo-Borghini's wheel and then outsmarted her and outmaneuvered her on the final climb up to the finish.
Vanderbreggen's final season, I mean, she's already started it with a win at Omloop. She'll become a DS with SD Works, so her pathway is already clear for next season when she retires at the end of this year. Only 30 as well.
Young, say, how old is she? I thought she, yeah.
Young to retire, Brad.
Yeah, but I don't know, she's achieved so much, isn't she, really, in the time she has been here. But I actually thought she was older because it seems like she's been around forever.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine, actually, a peloton without Anna Vanderbreggen and without that constant threat of when she'll attack and when she'll ride away from the bunch and how will the bunch catch her. It is young, I suppose, for her to retire when we know that certainly endurance as a sport kind of has a longer shelf life. But like you say, Brad, she's achieved so much and she's won so much. Where does that motivation continue to come from?
Yeah, and it's one of them big riders as well, isn't it? One of the talking points, you know, it's just to think this time next year she's not going to be present. And, you know, then at the same time, that's where a whole new sort of list of names come through, really. It's just, it's that almost changing the guard and the generation, really.
No Lizzie Deignan today.
No.
She was out with a cold.
Yeah. And she's another one, you know, you sort of, when you notice when she's not there and when she's present and she's not even in the reckoning, just her name in the race and her presence is enough, really, to have a talking point. But it's just going to be the same next year when Vanderbreggen's not there, you know.
I mentioned Vanderbreggen winning Omloop and the relative prize pot between what was on offer for the women at Omloop compared to what was on offer for the men at Omloop has rightly been the sort of main topic of conversation around the men's and the women's world tours this week. I mean, as I've already said, we're recording on Saturday after the racing at Strada Bianchi has finished. But with it being International Women's Day on Monday, there's possibly no better time to have a conversation on the subject of equality. So, Laura, we were talking about this at length earlier. The crowdfunding that Strada Bianchi had to rely on in the end today meant that the cash for the prize pot for the women's race actually exceeded the prize pot for the men's. So I know you've been keeping a close eye on this in terms of the numbers, but thanks to the public, not the race organisers, we must stress, there was a pot of more than €25,000 for the women's peloton, which exceeded the men's.
Yeah, so that was then added to the €6,298 that the race had initially put up. So that equaled over $31,800 at the time we're recording now, where the men for the top five riders were only receiving €31,600. So ironically, the women's prize pot is now bigger and growing than the men's. And Chantal Vanderbroek Black is looking to get over €10,000 for her win today as well. On the prize money debate, I think it's been raging on Twitter all week. And I think you can't really do a subject like that justice, a nuanced debate like that justice in 280 characters. And I know there's lots of different opinions flying around and whatever else. For me, I think with prize money, the rich get richer. And often if you've got SD Works winning week in, week out, which it seems is looking the way at the moment, that's not necessarily going to benefit the whole of women's cycling. It isn't this golden ticket that will fix women's cycling.
It's only going to benefit the top riders.
Exactly, yeah. But it's one piece of a big puzzle. I think TV coverage and the narrative is more important. But what it does scream out to me, the shocking disparity says, we value women less. That's what it says quite clearly. And when you look at the sort of pie chart that the Internationale's released, it says it so blatantly. And that's appalling as optics for current sponsors, for would-be sponsors looking to come into the sport.
It doesn't say you're particularly valued, though, as an athlete, with the public having to raise money for the prize fund that you're competing for, though, Brad.
Yeah, I never understood prize money, really. I mean, it's...
you had enough of it.
Well, no, I didn't, because I won everything, so it goes to the other people. You know, it's...
The people who work for you, you mean?
No, the riders, yeah. I just
in the race.
The tax bill.
Yeah, no, I'm not talking about your butler.
No, I mean, you know, I just, Prize money is sort of at the end of the season, you know, it gets split between the riders, and it's not something that's on your mind when you're racing. You know, you don't think, oh, I'll get third or fourth because, you know, there'd be a lot more money. It's just, for me anyway, it just never came into it. And I almost forget it's there sometimes, and it's kind of a nicety at the end of the season. But for racers to be under that much pressure to raise prize money, I mean, for me, racing should always be how prestigious it is to win a certain race and not what comes with it. You know, and the jersey and the materialistic items like a medal or a trophy become, you know, at the end of Paris-Roubaix, you get a cobble. I couldn't even tell you how much it is to win Paris-Roubaix prize money-wise. And that tells you everything, really. And it's you know, I think we need the races more than riders need the prize money. You know, riders get paid enough money in this day and age, and rightly so. And I think, you know, for races to be at jeopardy because they can't raise prize money to pay the riders on top, I think we should just be grateful that we've got racing on at the moment, and you know, the strain a lot of organisers are under in order to put these races on. I think it's an added pressure. The women's side is a bit different anyway because they're underfunded in many ways, and it's not equal. But certainly for the men's side of thing, in this day and age, the men should almost be willing to give up a side of the sport in terms of, you know, to improve. It's where everyone needs to help each other, really.
The races would say that they can't decrease the men's prize pot because of the UCI rules. UCI rules say, well, you've got to have a certain...
UCI rules say you can't have socks at a certain length, and UCI rules say you can't hug each other. So, I mean, you know, that's what happens. You know, we've got Mickey Mouse and his mates running the organisation. It's just the UCI. I mean, you know, that's a whole other episode.
Well, that's the thing. I think everyone was sort of screaming at the race organisers and Flanders Classics and saying, you know, this is awful, this is disgraceful. And I understand that. But actually, I think there is a wider subject, as you say, Brad, that this is ultimately the UCI who have power over their sport and need to police that and, you know, have the authority to say prize money must be equal or, you know, whatever they want to say. But they kind of need to step in and take responsibility as well.
There's a nice line from Lizzie Banks on this where she says there's no magic answer, but it's all part of creating an environment where women feel valued.
Yeah, absolutely.
But like you say, Laura, it's about putting all the pieces of the puzzle together to create that proper environment.
It was a constant story, isn't it? Every year we still have this same conversation.
Yes.
Nothing ever really seems to get done, does it?
This is what Eleanor Barker said, because she's guest edited Cycling Weekly, coming out this week, obviously in line with International Women's Day as well. And she basically says that she wishes that we could be talking about the brilliant racing and not sitting here moaning and moaning about no TV coverage and no prize money. And I feel like I've been talking about this since about 2014, 15, and it never seems to go away. And what's being lost is how bloody brilliant women's racing actually is. And I hate the fact I've even just said women's racing, because it's just racing. It's just bike racing and cycling, and it doesn't matter what's between your legs on the bike. It's just good sport.
And to paraphrase Eleanor Barker, she said that the best thing I can do as an athlete is to put on a show, and the best thing you can do as a reporter or a journalist is to report on all the drama and the intrigue and the value that we add in the best way that you possibly can. I think that's about right.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it was a brilliantly worded letter, and she put it all very succinctly as well. I think almost we add to the contribution, we contribute to the lack of coverage by sitting here talking about prize money when we could be talking about, well, let's talk about that brilliant teamwork from SD Works today. Let's talk about Ashley. Let's talk about Anna van der Breggen. But we're sitting here talking about prize money.
We never see David Le Patillon, do we, either?
Always very quiet.
Yeah, and we haven't seen him since the Tour de France last year.
Until the tour comes around, yeah.
He said, within 2 years, we're hopeful to have a women's Tour de France, but we don't know what it's going to be called yet. Now we're getting into the sort of March already. Tour de France a couple of months away, so it'll be 1 year. You know, can I kind of preempt this now, getting pushed aside and go, okay, we're still not in a position to have a women's Tour de France next year, which is all it is now. And it seems a constant theme, constant story. You know, it's like the women just a side piece seem to be, and, you know, a secondary story. And you never, you know, we keep saying the UCI. Actually, it's the leader of the UCI. We need some leadership from David Le Patillon. And I don't think we get that enough, really. For once of July, he comes out and says a few things and disappears again.
Can you see them leaning on COVID as an excuse on the pandemic?
They'll lean on anything they have to. But I mean, who knows?
Well, look, on women doing just as good a job. And Laura, I can see your quote getting some attention.
Which one? God.
No matter what's between your legs. on women doing just as good a job as the men and being rewarded for it. I caught up with Sherry Pridham, the first woman to take on a DS role in the men's world tour with Israel Startup Nation, of course, earlier in the week on Zoom.
Sherry Pridham, Sports Director at Israel Startup Nation, thank you for taking the time to join us on the Bradley Wiggins Show. You became the first woman to take up a sports director role at a men's world tour team when you joined ISN in December last year. And you've probably been the most popular person in the world tour ever since. Even the New York Times reported on your appointment. Tell us to start with, how have you found all the attention since taking up the role?
I never in my wildest dreams ever envisaged so much interest, I guess. And it has taken me by surprise. I mean, obviously now, what are we now? We're first week of March and we're still doing interviews. And I have to say, it has been relentless. But nonetheless, you know, I'm super, super proud to, I guess, to hold that role. And I guess I have a responsibility now, you know, to show every woman, young girl, that anything is possible.
On that note, actually, I understand that you've obviously had messages from people all over the world, but I wonder if any really stand out for you.
Absolutely. I've had that many, but the one that always sticks in my mind is a young girl called Marta messaged me on Instagram and said that she was absolutely delighted and thrilled that this was possible. And that her biggest dream would be to be a sports director at the Movistar men's team. And she's 14. And I just hit a chord, you know, just an emotional chord.
Yeah, that's rather lovely. What did you say to her? Did you respond? Or was it a case of you're still sort of getting through the mailbag, as it were?
No, I've tried to answer as many messages as I, you know, physically could. But that definitely warranted a message. And even her response when I took the time to message her was almost overwhelming for her, you know. So I think she's a little fan. We will keep in touch.
Yeah, and keep an eye, a DS of the future, perhaps. Does that sort of thing really show that you've got a real role to play in leading the way for women in men's cycling?
I never really thought of it that way, to be honest with you. But I realise the importance of the position and the opportunity that I've been given. So, yeah, now it's starting to sort of sink in that I have a responsibility and to show that, like I said, you know, that it is possible.
I mean, you're a former pro rider yourself, and you've gone from being a pro into 11 years, as I understand it, of running a men's team at continental level, most recently the Vitus Pro Cycling Squad. And you were also owner of Vitus too. So,
yeah.
So I mean, it's a world you've been absolutely immersed in. So presumably, not an awful lot changes for you in your day-to-day, but in terms of the attention on you from the outside, an awful lot has changed.
I mean, owning a team, you kind of get immersed in commercial meetings and sponsorship priorities and VIPs and arranging sportives and negotiating contracts. And so, you know, even car wraps and signing off on kit designs and everything you can possibly think of. So I've had a fair run at that now. I've been a team owner since 2013, and you know, I've seen the teams evolve and some obviously falling away. So I'm pretty proud of the fact that we've hung on for so long, but also, you know, the fact that I've been around the domestic scene for what feels like a lifetime.
Do I understand it right that you were faced with a difficult decision of winding up Vitus at the end of last year?
And
presumably the pandemic had an awfully large bearing on that decision and your capacity to be able to continue in that role.
And then as
one door closed, almost immediately another door opened with ISN.
If you rewind a little bit, so obviously the pandemic hit us and everybody else in the cycling world, and obviously worldwide for normal people, I guess. And, you know, we sort of thought, well, we can get through this. We might be racing in April. We might be racing in May. So the motivation was always there. And I think when we got the news that the Tour of Britain was going to be cancelled, that was our sort of last grasp at motivating the riders, you know, to get through the 2020 season. But all of this, while this was in the background, you know, we were working on potential partnerships for 2021 through to 2024 almost, and things were looking fairly positive, I have to say. We were quite close to a three-year deal, and then obviously as things progressed, we were getting to July, and I just received some bad news to say that, you know, the focus was going to be on online, marketing, and that they were not going to be supporting the team for those 3 years. So I says, thanks very much, and as you do, and I can still fight this. I genuinely believe that I could run the team on a very, very much reduced budget. And then we got the news that we lost another smaller sponsor. And that's how it sort of kept rolling. And that was August time. And I still believed I could take the team through, but pull the team back to elite level, sit out of all the UCI bureaucracy with paperwork and finances and that sort of thing. And then it started dwelling on me that, hey, if I don't find a job, then I'm not going to be able to support myself. And then all the doubts started, sneaking in, and I was thinking, what can I do? Applied for jobs. And then it was just one day, I think it was August, I thought, why not? Why can't I reach out to World Tour teams? And there was a handful of teams that I actually wanted to be involved with. I could see myself fitting in, and obviously there's certain teams where tradition and historic teams, like, well, I can't really say, but certain Belgium teams or French teams, for instance, wouldn't look at me to give those kind of opportunities. But I was looking for a team that I would be accepted and be able to bring something to. And actually, ISN were the first team to respond to my email. And within a week or so, I'd already had my first conversation with the general manager, Kjell Kolstrom, and it just went from there.
When you say that there are certain teams that wouldn't look at you, am I right in interpreting that as they wouldn't look at you because you're a woman?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to look at the real life. We always come up against, I guess, females, women. We come up against tradition, don't we? And you've got to remember, I'm sitting very much in a man's world, and you have to be accepted. You have to earn your respect, and with that comes a lot of responsibility. And you've almost got to almost prove yourself again. So I'm starting right on at the bottom, but I've got my feet under the table now, and I'm determined to to make things work.
In your career, Have you often, or with any sort of regularity, come across sort of bullying or abuse because you're a woman in the men's peloton?
No, I wouldn't say I wouldn't say bullying or anything like that, not at all. You do get the odd person that will sort of say, well, what do you think you're doing here, or but that's every day, not just so much. I think I've experienced it more, to be honest, in the commercial world than I have in the cycling world. Quite frankly, if you can do your job well and you drive your car, you get the respect of the other sports directors, then why shouldn't you be treated as an equal? And I haven't really had many issues over the past 15 years where it's hit home, you're the only woman in the set. But I never thought of it that way. I said, just crack on. I am what I am.
The best way to think about it, just crack on. Because you're stepping up from continental level to World Tour, do you feel any sort of added pressure there? And the second part of that question, do you feel any sort of added pressure because in the back of your mind you think, I'm making a little piece of history here?
Yeah, no. Outwardly, no. I mean, I believe I'm a relatively strong person. I'm strong-willed. If I want to go and get something, I will do everything I can. I'll swim the earth for it. And that's the way I've treated my whole cycling career, from when I was younger to when I came here as an 18-year-old, through to, racing here and looking for pro teams abroad, when in my generation, you had to do it the hard way. You were writing letters and having printed CVs almost and handing them out, So I've always fought for what I've wanted, and I've always, although I don't see them as dreams, I guess they are dreams. And I've always said that I wanted to work on a men's World Tour team. And that was equally so with the Conti team. I wanted my own team. I also believed I was going to take my own team to World Tour, but I think somewhere in the early 2012s, 2013s, I probably realized that, that wasn't going to happen.
Am I right in saying that this week was your debut in the team car, so to speak, at Le Samen?
Well, I was DS3, so I was there in support. for Dirk De Mol and for Eric van Lancker.
All the same, it must have been a disappointing experience in a way, having been so close with Sepp van Marck and Hugo Hofstetter finishing fourth and fifth, being sort of that close to the podium. What did you take away from the race?
It started well, and I think as with all teams, you know, everybody's facing issues. We not necessarily with just with the travelling, but also with all the COVID testing and such like. So I think the team can be super proud of our start in the opening weekend and opening races, and even, you know, Hout Var and Bessege and those races. I think we've been there or thereabouts. So.
Well, Michael Wood's doing it for you in Var as well.
That's it, yeah.
An important early win, I would imagine.
Absolutely, yeah. And Sepp is flying. You know, he's in super good nick, and he's motivated. And I think you saw that in Le Samen 2 days ago. You know, he had a couple of punctures, so he came back from that. He still had the tenacity to go out and you know, to try and do a long breakaway, and then ended up sprinting for the podium, I guess, for the win, and got fourth. And he was disappointed with that, you know, even with all his troubles and his the way he tackled the race. So we're happy, we're content.
We mentioned a couple of riders there, but you've got a squad actually full of talent and riders capable of winning the biggest races in the world. I mean, Dan Martin, yeah. Andre Greipel, Alex Dowsett, Daryl Impey, and obviously one man that I'm sure you've been asked a lot about, Chris Froome. What are your expectations, given the talent at your disposal? What are your expectations for the season ahead?
I think we've always looked as a sports directors group. We've always kept as positive and as focused, so everybody's on the same page. And I think when we were looking at the race program and doing the race planning in December, it was quite clear that any race that we went to on the program, whether it was a Grand Tour or an early season classic or a one-day race, whatever, we believe that we've got riders that can compete for the podium. And I think we've proved that so far. You know, we've got things we need to work on. You know, I know for a fact that at UAE, our sprint train improved as a group. On the road, every sprint opportunity, they got better and better at that. And with that comes confidence, and with confidence comes result.
So you talked about the sprint train briefly there. Are you happy with what you saw from Froome in the UAE? So top 50 overall, and you know, given the extent of the injuries that he suffered in his recce for the Dauphiné, how's he looking? Is he in the sort of shape that you'd hope?
I think you just said, you know, the extent of the injuries that Chris has had to deal with and the recuperation and rehab that he's had to go through. And we spent a lot of time as a team making sure that Chris's rehab has been where we need to be. So although he might be a little bit behind in where we need to be with Chris, every day at UAE, he was feeling better and better. So, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing Chris. We've got to believe, haven't we? And give him as much support. Likewise, all the guys. You know, we've got to remember, Chris is Chris Froome, but we have a whole team of super good riders: Van Marck, Daryl Impey, Dan Martin, Paddy Bevan, all those guys. You know, that can do a good result.
In a way, he's in a nice position because not as much as expected of him as it might have been before. So in a very real way, you're very much the underdogs. And yet he has, partly probably because he's been asked about it so much, but he has hinted that he would like to go for that record fifth Tour de France.
Yeah, why not? You know, I mean, it's one of the, I guess, instrumental reasons why we've brought him on board, you know, to give that a go. But you know, we're a long way out still in terms of, you know, thinking about the Tour de France, but we are building in the background. And I think from what I've seen and heard from his coaches and from the performance team that, you know, he's on track, mainly and most importantly, that his rehab is almost 99% done.
That's really good news. Have you got an idea of what his race program will look like for
I don't know. You know, that sort of gets dealt with by Rick Verbrugge, our head DS, and that's kind of updated pretty much when we have Monday meetings, DS meetings.
There might be a very obvious answer to this, but is there a race that you are most looking forward to playing your part in?
I've not given it a thought as far as that, but obviously I'm going to say the Tour de France. But you know, I'm going to have to be super, super good to, you know, to get to the Tour de France this year. But who knows? I'm next up at Tirreno Adriatica, so I'm looking forward to that. And then after that, we'll see. I know I'm doing the Tour of Britain as head DS, first DS. Mm-hmm. So that's something to look forward to as well.
Sherry, how would you describe yourself as a DS? I mean, are you animated? Are you sort of quite relaxed? I've heard, for example, that you're very much, as I think a lot of DSs are, a real stickler for attention to detail.
I am. I like to have a plan, certainly a good strategy and a well thought out strategy. And I like to do that when I present the strategies and the performance plans. And I've always said to the riders, you know, if we go out with a plan and we try and we have a plan A and a plan B, and, you know, who knows, as you know, things change on the road quicker sometimes than we can, you know, than we can deal with. But at least give it a go. And I think I'm calm. The way I'm talking to you now is probably the way I would be talking to my riders. Confident, clear. You might want to ask me that question when I get my first podium. I don't know how I would react, but I would imagine, knowing me, I would be a little bit emotional.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the in-car footage that you always see of the DS sort of high-fiving each other.
Yeah.
Actually, I should ask, where in the world are you talking to us from?
I'm in Derby.
Right.
So,
are you sort of based in the UK?
For this season, yeah. Fine. Yeah, for this season, I will be, yeah.
How do you relax away from cycling?
I enjoy running. We've also got a good DS group that likes to batter each other out on the road when we get the opportunity to go running. So I enjoy that. And I've got four dogs to keep me busy and keep them walked.
Well, that's a full-time job in itself.
It is, yeah.
Finally, Sherry, is there a question that you would like to put to Brad?
When are we going to see you at the first race, Brad? Come and say hello. Come and give us a bit of support, and we can continue with the questions.
I'm sure he'll be there like a shot. Well, Sherry Pridham, Sports Director at Israel Startup Nation, good luck for the season ahead. We really wish you well, and thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for your support.
So thanks again to Sherry Pridham for taking the time to speak to us. Brad, Laura, a woman as a DS at a men's world tour team, you love to see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it? We have to praise it because it's the first time. But at the same time, it shouldn't even be a news story in some ways. That's equality, isn't it? The fact we recognise it means there's a problem anyway. The fact we recognise it and talking about it as an issue, as a subject matter, means she's going to get more attention. We're drawing to attention to it. There's going to be extra pressure on her to say the right things. And this isn't the first for her. She didn't get really much attention when she was doing it in the British scene. But now it's on the world tour. It's sort of all ramped up a little bit more. I can tell you now, though, there's a lot of misogyny and bigotry within that peloton, within the older DSs, if you like, the likes of certain French managers and Belgian managers. I can only imagine them now in the race convoy when she's trying to get past or something like that. You can only imagine what's being said in the car.
She said actually that she wouldn't get a job at certain teams. She said as much.
100%.
And
yeah.
Having applied to.
Yeah. So good on Israel, Startup Nation. It's the first. Hopefully, it won't be the last. And I think she'll supersede most of the men in that peloton in terms of in the position she's in. She's got more experience than most of us, and certainly more than me. She was around the sport longer than I am. Yeah, good luck to her. I think she'll do a great job.
Like we say there, she's run a men's team for 11 years, owned a men's team.
Yeah.
At continental level, this is far from being something that's new to her, Laura.
I've always loved working with Sherry on the British scene. She's been brilliant. She's always great to interview. She gives you her time. She gives you a great soundbite. She knows what she's doing. And I, you're right, Brad. I wish it wasn't news. I wish it wasn't this enormous sort of celebration. And I understand why it is, but you just wish for a day where there isn't a blink of an eye when we say, oh, someone's come out as gay, or there's a woman doing this.
Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
life and normal. But unfortunately, we're not there yet. So we do need to keep celebrating the firsts, and we do need to praise, give praise where it's due. And for sure, Sherry Pridham, I think, will have a brilliant, brilliant time with Israel Startup Nation. And I wish her all the best.
After we finished recording, in fact, we spoke about the sort of psychological side to it too. But hopefully we'll get Sherry on the show in person later in the season. So coming around to Sherry's question to you, when are we going to see you at the first race?
Well, it's been a lot of Paris-Roubaix. Like, yeah, all being well. There is talk of having the motorbike there, Brad on the bike. So that'll be, hopefully that doesn't get cancelled because that would really be one to do.
I think it's something we're all looking forward to. One of the highlights of the summer, two summers ago. It seems a long time ago now. Welcome back to the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport. Brad, Laura, let's move on to the men's race today at Strade Bianche. We were hoping for what would turn into a classic, and it's fair to say the race lived up to expectations today. The seven that got away with about 22 kilometres to go was an all-star field, and then Matthew van der Poel put the rocket boosters on with about 12 kilometres to go. Only two could stick with him. Here is how Rob Hatch called the finish for us on Eurosport.
500 metres to go. Still no winner.
There he goes.
Now we get the move. Now we get the move. It's liftoff number two for van der Poel. And look at that difference. Look at the space open up. Bernal is out. It is van der Poel who's going away. Van der Poel's going to do it. Van der Poel is on fire. Mathieu van der Poel just rides them off his wheel. And Mathieu van der Poel is about to approach Piazza del Campo as the winner of Strade Bianche. He's going to be the first Dutch man to do it. And Alaphilippe, in the same arena where he was victorious 2 years ago, is going to be beaten. But beaten by an absolutely wonderful performance from an absolute machine of a bike rider. We have seen quite the race today. We have seen quite the bike racer. Mathieu van der Poel, a winner at Strade Bianche. It's heroic stuff, the head of the world champion. And Egan Bernal is also back.
So Brad, Matthew van der Poel, he was pretty much the out-and-out favourite. Julian Alaphilippe couldn't stick with him there at the end. Egan Bernal doing well to round out the podium.
Yeah.
But Brad, as a show of strength on that final climb, really putting the rocket boosters on, no one could stick with him. I mean, how about that from van der Poel?
Yeah, I mean, van der Poel, we say the favourite. I mean, every race he starts now, we're expecting that kind of performance from him, really. I mean, I watched the World Cyclocross Championship not too long ago, and I mean, he was ridiculous, dominant in there, wasn't he?
Well, really? he crashed and yeah. Wout van Aert went out and stretched out ahead of him and had a 20-second lead.
I think we watched this race last year, which was at a later date last year, wasn't it, when van Aert won.
Pretty much at a canter, yeah. And
every race in that period last year was at Lombardy, and that van der Poel was kind of distanced, and it was a surprise, really. But I hope this is his season now, Flanders and races like that, Paris-Roubaix. I think every race he starts now, we expected a performance like that. Good for Bernal. He's sort of seems to be putting last year's Tour de France behind him now.
He's doing the Giro, of course, and Bernal was only supposed to be there as a sort of finding his feet in Italy and sort of part of his acclimatization as a long look at the Giro. But Laura, that final seven in particular, all-star cast.
Yeah, all the protagonists were out to play. It was so exciting. Before the race, I said to myself, if we've got Julian Alaphilippe, Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel, the final three coming into that last kilometre, it's going to be fireworks. And okay, we had two of those, but we also had Egan Bernal. And I think it's actually brilliant to see Bernal back at the pointy end of a race. I know he came third and he was distanced 20 seconds on that last climb by Mathieu van der Poel.
In the last kilometre.
Ridiculous. Yeah, absolutely. But it's good to see him back, where I think we are used to seeing him, where we want to see him, certainly if he's going to be a contender and match kind of Pogacar for the Grand Tours and so on. But just extraordinary stuff from Mathieu van der Poel. The explosion, the acceleration was insane. I'm not sure that Twitter erupted, didn't it? I'm not sure we've sort of seen stuff like that for a long time. He was just incredible.
I mean, the other four in that final seven, so Wout van Aert came fourth, Thomas Pidcock, Ineos in fifth, a lot's been expected of Tom Pidcock, Michael Gergel and Tadej Pogacar. They came in almost a minute down. You'd think, certainly given how Van Aert, for one, performed last year, that they'd have been closer to the podium. But I think we saw Van Aert and Pidcock just sort of, as they were distanced within the last 30 kilometres, they burnt a few matches to try and get back on to that front group. And they just didn't have enough left.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, Tom Pidcock wasn't really going to work in that chase group when you had Bernal up the road. But I think what a performance we've seen from Tom Pidcock. He was third at Omloop last week. Now he's come in and finished fifth at Strada Bianca. Like, the kid's incredible. He's only 21 years old. He is going to be an absolute sensation. He already is, really. But the future is so bright for him.
Yeah. Kerner Brussels. It's same weekend, but I think he was third at Kerner Brussels, wasn't he?
Yes.
Jake Stewart was second at Omloop, the Groupama FDG rider. And he was fifth overall at Bessèges too. Brad, you know fine well what it's like to be a young rider on that team in a French squad and a sort of proudly French squad as well. Give us a flavour of what Jake Stewart will be going through this season.
Yeah, so I signed with him 20 years ago this year.
That's incredible.
Yeah, end of 2001.
Yeah.
So my first season, 2002, was with FDJ. So yeah, 20 years ago. And it's still the same makeup, pretty much the same group of guys. Marc Madieu, Yvon. I'm not sure if Marcel Gaillon and others are still there. But yeah, still Frank Pinot's there. Same directors. And they've had, they've had a lot of success in that 20 years. I mean, they started in 1997, so they're getting on for 25 years old now, that team. One of the longest sponsored teams. So after Max Chandry and myself, he's the third, isn't he, Jake?
He is indeed.
Which I didn't know until you told me the Graham, the encyclopedia.
Well, I've got that information from elsewhere as well. So apparently Mario said to Stuart, the last British rider I had on this team was Bradley Wiggins.
Probably.
So you'd better be effing good.
Yep. Probably did.
Who do you expect to really rise to the top there? Can Pidcock be the next real superstar?
Yeah, I mean, he's getting on with that already, isn't he? Yeah, he's already made an impact. I think there's a lot more to come from him. I think it's going to be challenging for him to think what direction to go in, whether he's going to be a GC rider. You could see him certainly going the way the Yates is in that sort of vein, you know, winning races like Liège-Bastogne-Liège and being up there in those. But the big question is going to be whether he goes for GC, isn't it?
Yeah.
Something like the Tour de France. But I think I'd say he's got time for that. You know, so, wait a couple of years, but get things under your belt, smaller races. I could see him doing well in Tour of the Basque Country, you know, Tour of Lombardy, all these races. I mean, it's quite difficult when you can do anything like he can. He's a very, very similar rider to Mathieu van der Poel, isn't he?
Yeah, you know, in lots of ways. I mean, cyclocross background.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, but just that he's got the punchiness. You know, he's quick in a sprint. He can time trial. Riders like that now. You know, we got Julien. He can do anything. We were asking about Van Aert last year. Can he win a Grand Tour? That's the modern rider now. They can do anything at any time of the year.
Jake Stewart, what would your advice be to him? Not, and I'm sure you will say to me, you know, I'm in no position to give him any advice, but having sort of been there yourself, yeah. As you say, you signed 20 years ago today, and Laura will come on to the kid's age, I should say, really, because even saying that he was born in 1999
offensive.
Is crazy.
He was two when I signed for.
But what would your advice be to a young rider?
Learn dialect French. So I learned French from the Picardy region by. I didn't speak a word of it. I didn't even get entered for French GCSE. And I learned dialect French, you know, like roadman French, if you like, in London. And it makes it so much easier speaking within that team and that, you know.
He says his French is coming on. Laura, they're already making a name for themselves. How do you see it for Pidcock and Stewart this season? What can you see them doing in terms of how high can they go?
Sky's the limit, I suppose, and they've already shown themselves. The thing is, at the moment, there isn't too much pressure on them. Both results were kind of surprises to an extent. No one quite knew what certainly Pidcock's form was going to be coming into the opening weekend, having spent the winter in cyclocross. I've got to say also the nature with which Stewart finished second. If you haven't seen the sprint, he finds gaps that aren't there. He squeezes between the barrier on the left-hand side, and he said, if he had been in the wheels of Ballerini, he probably would have certainly challenged him further. So I think, yeah, those two kids certainly show that the future's bright for British cyclists coming through, which is great to see, as you've got people like Geraint Thomas, Chris Froome coming arguably towards the end of their careers. It's nice to see this new generation stepping up and racing in a very different way to what we certainly saw throughout the 2010s with Team Sky and Brad and kind of their dominance.
Mm. Mm. I mean, you mentioned Froome again there, and obviously we've heard from Sherry Pridham on what they might expect from Froome this year. And she said, why not? If he's going for a fifth Tour de France, is he capable of doing it? It's quite a nice position for him to be in a way, and he said as much, in that he's now a team that's not necessarily expected to win it.
No, and I think that's probably what he needs at this stage of his career. You know, the regaining of the confidence and the, you know, his physical condition this year, but... he's capable of a fifth, definitely. I think the racing has changed so much just in the last 2 years alone. The way the races, the riders that are capable of doing well. The Tour de France, the structure of the Tour has changed in the last 2 years, the way they race it. It's very close now to the last stages. And I think it's going to be difficult for him, but it's never easy winning the Tour de France. So he's going to have a job on, but probably going to have to see a bit more from him than we have done up to this point. You know, a bit more, you know, of a performance at some point, but I'm still not going to underestimate him. The minute you underestimate Chris Froome is the day that you you pay for it, really. I think he's an amazing athlete, and he's got certainly something left in him. Otherwise, he wouldn't be racing, I don't think.
And on the Tour, looking away forward to the Tour, but Tao and Thomas will be Team Sky's A team.
Yeah,
leading their squad over in France this summer. Is that the right move for Tao, Brad? So Dave Brailsford has said, in terms of Tao's development, the Tour is the next best step for him, and not for him to go back and defend his Giro title.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. I don't know, it's a funny one, that, isn't it? It would have been nice to see him back, wouldn't it? Defending that title.
It's always good to see.
Funny one with Dave. You don't know, really, you never know whether he's telling the truth or not. You know, I don't know if they're basically... He's still, in Dave's mind, third in line behind Egan and G. And he's got to keep those people happy. He's got to feed his top athletes. And so coming out with that and saying that Tao, now the next best step is for him to go to the Tour, knowing that he's going to play second fiddle to G. Because he's got to manage this. He's got to manage these players, really. So keep Bernal happy by sending him to the Tour. Because it wasn't happy, you know, it wasn't happy at the Tour last year. I know that the two camps weren't very happy with each other, you know, the sort of Bernal camp and the G camp, and that's why G ended up going to the Giro, really. They can't really have them two on the same race, I would imagine, because it doesn't... Well, whereas Tao will be happy to play second fiddle to G.
So they've got
to split them, really, that way. So I think, you know, keeping, you know, G going for the Tour and Egan going for the Giro.
Yeah, so it looks like Bernal will be supported by... Well, he will be leading the Giro team with Pavel Sivakov, and they'll be supported by Filippo Ganna, who obviously dominated the race in terms of stage wins last year, and Bernal's fellow Colombian, Daniel Martinez, their new signing from EF Education Nippo, as they'll be known this season. So it's Tao and Thomas for the Tour, with Richard Carapaz, Ineos's third option, and they've got a sort of deluxe domestique in Richie Porte, third on the podium last year, and they'll likely be backed by Laurens de Plus, Mikhail Kwiatkowski, Castro Viejo, Luke Rowe, and Dennis obviously was almost MVP for Tao at the Giro in terms of the work he did to support him. So in terms of race programme, it's Paris-Nice this week for Tao. That begins tomorrow. So again, Brad, looking back to your time going for the Tour, Paris-Nice, the first real important marker for you in the season.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's on French soil. It gives you a flavour of what, you know, the Tour is going to be like. It's raced very similar to the Tour de France. The only difference is it's very cold, and you have a lot more weather conditions to contend with generally this time of year in France, particularly the rain and snow in some parts. But I think that's, you know, we always took a French kind of French calendar really in the run up to the Tour, aside from Romandy, and I think nothing's much has changed there, really. It's, you know, if you're racing in France and going for the Tour de France, it's good to get used to racing in France and the roads. And it, you can, you know, before Paris-Nice in 2012, we went and looked at a few of the stages of the Tour. We went and looked at the last time trial in La Chartre for the Tour. So we already started the recon, you know, this far out, because it coincided with the start of Paris-Nice, and the time trial wasn't far from there. So we killed two eggs with one stone. Two pigeons with one egg.
Paris-Nice will be the first time that we see the super squads, if you like, of Jumbo-Visma and Ineos showdown this season. So it's where Primoz Roglic will start his season, supported by Stefan Kreischwick, George Bennett, Leonard Hofstetter and Tony Martin. Whereas Ineos will have Teo and Richie Porte, Rowan Dennis, basically the bulk of what we expect to be their tour team, with Geraint Thomas the exception, over in Tirreno Adriatico, which starts in the middle of next week. How do you see the showdown, if you like, between Jumbo-Visma and Ineos?
It's hard to say. We haven't really seen much of a hit out. I think UAE Tour, I mean, Tadej Pogačar won that. So kind of between Jumbo-Visma and Ineos, we haven't seen the big trains come to the fore. We haven't seen that form. So I think for that, it's going to be incredibly exciting just to get a glimpse and a taste of what we'll be expecting in June, July. I don't know. Anything could happen, couldn't it? I think that's the brilliant thing. And certainly this season just feels like, because last year was so bizarre and so unprecedented, as we keep saying, this season feels like form is a little bit unknown because the running has been different. So I'm excited to see what's going to happen between both races, Tirreno Adriatico and Paris-Nice.
Mm. And presumably we'll see a lot from Sam Bennett and Pascal Ackermann in the sprints too.
Yeah.
But you're looking forward to seeing Cav back this season as well, and back in a team where he feels, we assume, a lot more
comfortable. He looks happy. Yeah. He looks really happy, and he sounds happy. Hopefully it's not his last year, but, you know, we sat, didn't we, at the end of last year, and we watched the whole sort of tears at Gent-Wevelgem and thought that that might be it, and we wouldn't get this chance to see him again. So, you know, special mention to Cav.
Yeah, and hopefully we might even have him on the show at some point. Ooh, over the course of the nice. Season. That brings us to the end of this episode of the Bradley Wiggin Show by Eurosport. Thank you to our sponsor, Zwift, where fun is fast. Thank you, Brad. It's good to see you again after a winter's break. And special thanks to our special guest.
Laura Summer.
Laura Winter. Laura, quickly, before we all lose it, where can we find you on social media if we want to?
It's at Laura C. Winter on both Instagram and Twitter.
On all good social channels. Brad, where can we find you?
So we go.
You can also follow Eurosport on Twitter at Eurosport_UK, and you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Special thanks extended to our producer, podcast Pete.
Thanks, half hour.
Pete Burton.
Yes, Pete.
Finally from me, Graham Wilgos, it's goodbye. If you've enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, share your thoughts and rate us. Brad, as I said, we will be back next week for the final stage of Paris-Nice, and it will be stage 5 of Tirreno Adriatico. So lots to look forward to as the stage racing gets serious. Laura, thanks again.
Thank you for
joining
us. Having me.
Superb to have you as always. Brad, last word.
Goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.